Hello, I'm Bill Law. Thank you for listening to the Crossing Continents podcast. This week I report from Canada on how an alleged terrorist plot has created tensions in a country that prides itself on being the most welcoming and open society in the world.
And now the five-day forecast, meteorologist Brian Hill.
It'll be partly sunny today. It, however, will be windy, so our guaranteed high minus 2 will feel about minus 15 with the wind chill this morning.
And it's been 20 years since I've been in Toronto in the winter. I'd forgotten just how bitterly cold it can be. That much hasn't changed, but this city has grown by leaps and bounds. Nearly 5 million people live here. It's all motorways and shopping malls and huge suburban housing estates that run north and east and west, everywhere but south. South is Lake Ontario, a huge body of water, sitting like a cold hand, with fingers of wind that penetrate to the bone. Running into the city along the lakefront, you see minarets and mosques. That, too, is new. 40 years ago, there were a handful of Muslims in Toronto. Today, it is the most ethnically diverse city in the world. And nearly 1 in 10 people here are Muslim. Canada is supposed to be one of the most welcoming of countries. In this week's Crossing Continents, I want to find out just how welcome Canadian Muslims feel, and how some may be testing the country's tolerance.
90% of the Muslims in Canada are immigrants, our first generation, so born in some 30 countries. So that's, 800,000 people suddenly in your midst. And when we ask them, what is it that they appreciate about life in Canada? One of the things is freedom of religion. And, of course, we in Canada, who are actually post-Christian, are still able to tolerate people who are believers.
Michael Adams is the president of one of Canada's leading polling companies, Environics. Last year, the company released the results of the first ever poll of Muslims living here. It made for reassuring reading.
The promise of multiculturalism is being kept, and that is, come to Canada, obey the laws, get a job, send your kids to school, and live a good life. And by the way, you're allowed to retain your cultural traditions. That's your religion, your language, if you wish to do so, and so on. This is the reasonable middle road of multiculturalism. That promise is being realized for this group, as it is for so many.
That's interesting, because multiculturalism in Britain is almost a dirty word, because it's seen by some people as a kind of a backdoor to eroding the essential fabric of British culture, British society. But here what you're saying is that multiculturalism is working.
A main reason is this, is that we don't have an anxious majority here. The core, the quote-unquote majority would be WASPs, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. They're only 15% of the Canadians. So there's just too many races for racism in this country.
Canada, some would argue, is the best, the most successful liberal democracy in the world. It got there, enthusiasts like Michael Adams say, by embracing immigration, turning away from the American model of the melting pot, and building a multicultural mosaic. But there is a dark side to the rosy picture he paints. In June 2006, 18 young Canadian Muslim men were arrested, suspected of being members of two linked cells. They were allegedly poised to carry out massive terrorist attacks in Toronto and the country's capital city, Ottawa. It was profoundly disturbing to Canadians. It was a shock to me, living in the UK. How could this have happened in Canada? I asked myself. I'm on Front Street, in the heart of downtown Toronto, in a biting winter wind. Behind me is the soaring icon of the CN Tower. And just across the street are two of the alleged bombers' key targets, the Toronto headquarters of CSIS, the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, and the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation's Broadcast Center.
When I found out about that, I was like, oh my God, that's me. These guys were planning to attack, take over the CBC, and broadcast their message.
Nazim Basht is a Toronto-based journalist with the CBC. He's covered the story of Canadian Muslims extensively. He's a Muslim himself. As he delved into the background of the so-called Toronto 18, he uncovered an uncomfortable paradox.
We have a federal department of multiculturalism. We have multiculturalism enshrined in the Charter of Rights and Freedom. How could this happen in Canada? Well, we don't have that sense of victimization that other parts of the world, in Western Europe, the Muslims experience. What exists here is affluence. And with affluence, guilt. With affluence comes the idea that, what are we? How can we sit here in the laurels in the lap of luxury and have our brothers suffer in other parts of the world? How can we allow that? What kind of Muslims are we if we don't do something? Look at our parents. They came here and they sit there and they do their jobs and live in their big houses and drive their nice cars and eat nice food and they don't care about Muslims. Are they proper Muslims? Are they good Muslims? We are better Muslims. We're going to show them how good we are. That is what is happening here. It's the guilt from affluence.
To understand something about this paradox, you have to understand one very controversial and divisive figure. His name is Mubin Sheikh. He infiltrated the Toronto 18 and is the prosecution's star witness. A devout Muslim, he says he became concerned about jihadists in Canada after a friend of his was arrested and subsequently convicted of planning terrorist attacks in the UK. He offered to work with CSIS, the Canadian Security Intelligence Service. He was steered towards what's known in the trade as persons of interest. Mubin Sheikh was undercover for roughly 8 months. He describes the alleged plot.
It was attacking Parliament Hill, letting off car bombs in the vicinity to facilitate our exit, beheading members of Parliament, demanding the withdrawal of Canadians from Afghanistan. Then there was attacking power grids, then there was attacking the CBC, attacking the Secret Service or intelligence offices here. The mindset is create chaos and destruction. Yes, they're grandiose plans. Yes, they had absolutely no prospect of pulling it off. But that's not the point. Where you have an intention, where you set as your objective bombing places, innocent people, committing acts of terrorism, actively recruiting people to the group and actively training them to come to a level of readiness, come on. It's inconsequential to me whether or not they had operational capabilities to do those things. At this point, it doesn't matter. Because all it takes is it could be maybe a guy hung around with them for 3-4 weeks, he got what he needed, and he went off and did his own thing. Then what? The other adult accused ended up plotting, intending, actively seeking out ways to develop an ammonium nitrate-based bomb. 3 tons of ammonium nitrate.
Unlike another Crown witness, Mubin Sheikh refused the offer of going into a witness protection program. He says to do that would be to suggest that he had done something wrong. More importantly, it would silence his voice in the community. He says more Muslims like him need to openly challenge extremism. But he's paid the price for that decision.
I was cursed. My children were cursed. My family was cursed.
Cursed by?
Well, other people, other so-called Muslims, right? I mean, mostly online muftis, right? Cyber muftis, right? These are the wackos that, you know, they go online, they read a verse in English, and they think, ah, yes, this is what the Quran says. And then they go out and they teach this, and because they think they're big scholars now, right? It's a do-it-yourself Islam.
Defense lawyers contend that Mubin Sheikh was in effect an agent provocateur. He is well known in the Toronto Muslim community, and before the alleged plot was uncovered, was respected by young Muslims both for his Islamic scholarship and his fundamentalist views. It was a scholarship that ultimately convinced him that violent jihad was un-Islamic. But before that time, he admits he was attracted to militant Islam.
There are people that you knew from the area, not necessarily from the area, but from the Muslim community, that you could go to if you were interested in doing so. And because I have family in India also, that was another route that I could have taken. I remember being told that, well, you know, sit tight, go to India under the guise of visiting grandparents or whatever, and from there you can find your way. We will make a way for you, right? So in those years of angry youth, you know, it was like a a very modern juxtaposition, because on one hand I was very jihadi, but on the other hand I was into music and, you know, doing all kinds of things. And so I did look at wanting to go, and I did feel that, you know, Afghanistan was always the theater of choice, right?
Many in the Muslim community believe that the Toronto 18 are innocent victims of a ceaseless effort to harass and discredit Muslims. They point to the fact that charges against 7 have been stayed and that only 1 has been convicted. The remaining 10 still face trial. And Muslims are aggrieved at the many visits that intelligence officers pay to homes and businesses for what is termed informal chats. They feel, they say, like a community under siege, guilty by association with the broadest of brushstrokes. Although the police and CSIS have numerous outreach programs, I've heard these views repeatedly from secular Muslims, from business people, from students, and from respected imams. Toronto is a huge, sprawling city. We've been driving for about 40 minutes, heading north to the suburb of Richmond Hill as the snow begins to fall. It's one of Canada's wealthiest communities, and I've come to the Islamic center of York Region, two substantial buildings set on a 26-acre property. I'm here to see Zafar Bangash, the president of the center. Do you feel that the Muslim community is a community under surveillance?
Oh, absolutely. I not only feel, I know it. I get calls from people all the time telling me that, you know, they have been visited at their place of work by CSIS agents. They're being interrogated. They're being, you know, asked about X, Y, Z, and so on. And they're being harassed all the time. So it's not something that I feel. I know it. And I'm absolutely convinced that our centers are being monitored. And I've confronted the security officials on this as well.
When you look at these situations, what you see, because we're a liberal democracy, as some would argue, the most effective liberal democracy in the world, when these things happen, what does it say to you?
Well, what this indicates to me is that definitely the government is moving away from these values. That on the one hand, it claims that Canada is a pluralistic society, that we welcome everybody. And on the other hand, it is specifically targeting people of a particular faith.
The contradiction that Zafar Bangash highlights threatens to chip away at Canada's multicultural mosaic. But Canadians are still striving to achieve a middle ground. Sometimes, though, it's difficult. Friday prayers are just ending. It's a very ordinary scene. Families leaving the mosque, getting into cars, or waiting at the bus stop. One woman, though, stands out in her niqab, her veil, and her burqa. She comes from a family that is at the center of a human rights debate that tests the limits of liberal democracy. Her name is Zainab Haddar. The Haddars have been called Canada's first family of terror by the right-wing press. Zainab's father, an associate of Osama bin Laden, died in a firefight with Pakistani troops in 2003. One brother is paralyzed from the waist down after being wounded in the same battle. Another is in jail in Toronto fighting extradition to the United States on terror charges. And then there is her brother Omar, Guantanamo's youngest inmate. He was seized in Afghanistan at the age of 15 in 2002 and is still being held by the Americans 6 years on. Zainab, a tough and articulate 29-year-old, has assumed the mantle of family spokesperson. The majority of Canadians support the campaign to repatriate Omar. He is, after all, the only citizen of a Western country still held in Guantanamo. But at the same time, they find Zainab's hardline Islamist views abhorrent. How do you view jihad?
How do I view jihad? I think everyone has a right to their land. I mean, I can't say that what the Afghans are doing is wrong. It would be unrealistic and unjust to say that.
This is the Taliban fighting the central government and the American and NATO forces.
I'm talking about the Afghans in general. I'm not talking about any particular Jama'ah or any particular people. I mean, if the people want to be governed by the Taliban, that's, as far as I'm concerned, is their problem or their right or whatever. I don't think the Americans should be there or the Canadians should be there. And I don't think that anyone should be able to say that what the Iraqis or the Afghans are doing is wrong. And if that is jihad, then I think they have a right to it.
If a young Muslim man came to you for advice and said, I want to go to Afghanistan to fight jihad, what would you say to that young man?
I would tell that person to teach himself his religion, to be a good person, to educate himself, to be able to stand up on their own. And If he feels that he wants to live in a Muslim country or be around Muslims, then if you feel you are ready to relocate, then do it. But know that it's always a struggle to move, to change, and it's not about the fight. The fighting is the easy part. You're excited and you go and you fight. That's not making a difference.
That's the easy part.
In a way, because, you know, in a rush, teenagers can go out together and, you know, one of them would do something really stupid and the other ones would just, in the rush, in the heat of the moment, would do it. So I think it's a lot more to do with building a person, building a society, building a family, than just the fight.
Should Canadians be worried that young Muslim men might carry out terrorist attacks here in Canada, as happened in Britain, in London?
I don't think so. I don't think there's anything to worry about. I would really hope, though, that the Canadian government would change its policies abroad, because I think that affects the relations between people in a country. I think that justice brings justice, just like injustice brings injustice, or violence brings violence. So I think that if Canada just revises its policies, its international policies, then they will have nothing to fear.
What about the Toronto 18? Its allegation, charges have been dismissed or stayed in some cases, but there are still 10 people who are facing trial for what allegedly was a very, very serious attack.
The Toronto 18 is a hack. It's just a bunch of kids being crazy, and there is nothing to it. It's been 2.5 years. And if it wasn't for Mubin Sheikh, none of this case would have ever existed.
So Canadians can take it from you that they have nothing to fear.
In Canada? From Muslims in Canada? I don't think so.
Well, like I said, that'll be a relief for people then, because, as you know, people do worry. And it has happened. It happened in the city I live in, London, with terrible consequence. When you look at an action like that, what do you think?
How do I look at it? That's a difficult question, and pain is pain. It hurts everybody the same. I don't think that the Americans or the British feel pain more than other people.
So, would you condemn that attack?
Well, I would. I'm not the people who did it. I don't know why they did it. I don't know what drew them to do it, so I cannot be the one to speak on their behalf.
Well, they're dead, but surely you would have to take a view on it. You could say that this attack does not represent what Islam is all about. You could take that view, or you could, I suppose, take another view. I mean, I would just like to know what your view is.
I don't like to hear about people dying, but I cannot justify or condemn the actions of others. I think that's for them to do. And if they're dead, then, you know, God is the judge of their actions.
Many Canadians, including Muslim Canadians, are distressed, even frightened, by what Zainab Khadr has to say. But they recognize she has the right to those views and the freedom to express them. Canadians take pride in the democracy and its openness. But there is less to be proud about in the case of Muslim Canadians like Mahir Arar. He was arrested in New York on his way back to Canada. He was sent to Syria and tortured. His case provoked a public outcry, a royal commission, and an apology and a $10 million settlement from the Canadian government. Less well known is the curious story of Aboussfian Abdelrazak, a Canadian of Sudanese origin. He went to Sudan to visit his mother, and he can't come home. His lawyer is Yavar Hamid.
After a few months of being in Sudan, he was called to a meeting by Sudanese authorities, and he was arrested, detained in 2 terms, spent approximately about 2 years in detention in Sudanese prisons, and there was no charge, there was no basis for those detentions. In the course of dealing with this case, I have learned through Privacy Act disclosures that the Government of Canada is highly implicated. Our documentation indicates quite clearly, in one document in particular from the Department of Foreign Affairs, that Mr. Abdelrazak back in 2003 was being held by the Sudanese at, quote-unquote, our request, the Canadian government's request.
CSIS became interested in Mr. Abdelrazak because he was acquainted with Ahmed Rassam, the man convicted in the United States in 2005 of attempting to blow up Los Angeles International Airport. We've been trying to reach him in Sudan via a computer call-up.
If you are Canadian.
Now, here's the strange thing about Mr. Abdelrazak. When he was released from jail, his passport had expired. The Canadian government refuses to renew it. But, being Canada, they've let him stay at the embassy for the last 8 months.
Operation Center, bonjour.
After several attempts, we get through, and I ask him what he would say to the Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, if he had the opportunity.
I would say to him that why he don't bring me back in Canada and charge me there. I'm willing for that.
You're willing to come back to Canada, and if you're charged, to defend yourself?
Yeah, if they claim they have evidence and to make a justice trial, I am willing. And I'm Canadian citizen. I have the right, I guess, to come back to Canada, and I really want to come back to Canada.
Can I ask you this? On its website, the U.S. State Department says that you pose a significant risk of committing acts of terrorism. It also claims that you're a member of an extremist cell in Montreal whose members include Ahmed Ressam, the so-called Millennium Bomber. Is that true?
That is not true. That's what they claimed. It's not true. I'm a religious person, but I'm a terrorist.
There has been no official explanation as to why Mr. Abdulrazak isn't being allowed to come home. But cases like these are creating new challenges and tensions. The government is charged with both protecting Canadians from terror and with upholding the rule of law. Many Muslims see the treatment of Mr. Abdulrazak and Mahir Arar as hypocrisy, a violation of everything a liberal democracy stands for. And extremists can use a contradiction to exploit young minds. So what is the way forward? Looking for an answer takes me to my hometown of Ottawa.
In that recent Environics poll, the thing that Muslims like least about Canada was the cold. And I can identify with that. It's minus 20. I'm standing outside what I used to know when I was a kid as the Cow Palace. It's in an area of Ottawa called Lansdowne Park. It's a Victorian structure, but the size of three football fields with a high arched roof. It's been lovingly restored. And in this cold, bright, sunny air, it looks beautiful. And thousands of Muslims from the Ottawa area have come to celebrate the first day of Eid.
Dr. Yihad Delic is a Bosnian immigrant who came to Canada in 1995. He's the executive director of the Canadian Islamic Congress.
I remember one young boy in Vancouver when I was imam in the largest mosque. He came to me and said, I want to go to jihad. I looked at him, I gave him a smile, and I said, why? He said, I want to sacrifice something for God. I said, good. I need a volunteer in this mosque, and believe me, that would be your jihad, to serve your community, to serve your society, giving your life for nothing. A, you are not a soldier. B, you'll be shot in a moment. I know, I come from Bosnia.
And this young man, did he take your advice?
Oh yeah. This young man, actually, he became my right hand. And he took on my advice. He went to college, he went to university. I went actually last year from here to perform his marriage back in Vancouver. A very successful young person, very good Canadian. So what sometimes these young people, they just need a small advice, small direction.
But they can't get it from the wrong person.
You see, that's a problem. We are suggesting, I've been suggesting to several agencies of government that a radicalization example cannot be solved by CCs or RCMP. The only solution is right people from the community. People who know, A, text, and people who understand context, who are able to juggle between these two.
What Dr. Delic is suggesting is, of course, a very Canadian solution. Give Muslims the space and time to lead youth away from violent jihadism. That's a solution from within the community. But how do you deal with prejudices that exist both within and towards Canadian Muslims? Well, how about humor? When the Canadian sitcom Little Mosque on the Prairie launched in 2003, creator Zarqa Nawaz faced a storm of criticism.
I have noticed that every attitude that we expose, the people who own that attitude aren't happy with it, right? The right wing doesn't like being made fun of. The Orthodox Muslims don't like being made fun of. You do it, but, you know, there's a price to pay because people are very sensitive. They don't see themselves the way we see them. You know, they're like, are you making fun of us? Are you mocking us?
Despite the initial criticism, the show has been a hit. In its gentle, very Canadian way, Little Mosque on the Prairie extracts the sting from ignorance and animosity. And it's not alone. Young Muslims are exploiting the internet and using comedy to make their point. Frisk me, I'm a Muslim. That's on a t-shirt you can snap up online for just $15.
Whenever I go on the internet, you know, there's all sorts of websites that are... Have you heard of hijabman.com?
No.
And so there's all these websites popping up, hijabman, maniac Muslim. So there's all these websites from these young Muslims who are growing up in North America who are... And I think you have to be well integrated into North America to be able to make fun of yourself and your community. The way the Jewish community responded to prejudice back in, you know, the day in the 1920s and 30s. And so you see the best sitcoms that have come out in Hollywood have been from Jewish comics. And I think now you're seeing a similar pattern happening from the Muslim community. And I think it almost took that type of oppression to bring it out, because then you have a subject to talk about. And, you know, you can diffuse all the ignorance and hate with humor. And so I think that, you know, in 10, 20 years from now, you will see a sort of a different landscape. In the entertainment world, you'll see a lot more Muslims talking about these issues.
Maybe by then, Canadians, be they Muslim or otherwise, can relax. In the meantime, though, the promise of a multicultural society where people are free to practice their religion and prosper remains a threat. From the tiny minority who cynically exploit the freedoms Canada offers, and ironically, from the dangers that an overreaction to that minority can produce. But Canada, being Canada, will probably muddle through to what pollster Michael Adams calls a reasonable accommodation. How boring, how Canadian, I say to him. Yeah, he replies, but it works. Thank you for listening to the Crossing Continents podcast. If you'd like to find out more about Cross, log on to our website at bbc.com. Unlike another Crown witness, Mubin Sheikh refused the offer of going into a witness protection program. He says to do that would be to suggest that he had done something wrong. More importantly, it would silence his voice in the community. He says more Muslims like him need to openly challenge extremism. But he's paid the price for that decision.
I was cursed. My children were cursed. My family was cursed.
Cursed by?
Well, other people, other so-called Muslims, right? I mean, mostly online muftis, right? Cyber muftis, right? These are the wackos that, you know, they go online, they read a verse in English, and they think, ah, yes, this is what the Quran says. And then they go out and they teach this, and because they think they're big scholars now, right? It's a do-it-yourself Islam.
Defense lawyers contend that Mubin Sheikh was in effect an agent provocateur. He is well known in the Toronto Muslim community, and before the alleged plot was uncovered, was respected by young Muslims both for his Islamic scholarship and his fundamentalist views. It was a scholarship that ultimately convinced him that violent jihad was un-Islamic. But before that time, he admits he was attracted to militant Islam.
There are people that you knew from the area, not necessarily from the area, but from the Muslim community, that you could go to if you were interested in doing so. And because I have family in India also, that was another route that I could have taken. I remember being told that, well, you know, sit tight, go to India under the guise of visiting grandparents or whatever, and from there you can find your way. We will make a way for you, right? So in those years of angry youth, you know, it was like a very modern juxtaposition, because on one hand I was very jihadi, but on the other hand I was into music and, you know, doing all kinds of things. And so I did look at wanting to go, and I did feel that, you know, Afghanistan was always the theater of choice, right?
Many in the Muslim community believe that the Toronto 18 are innocent victims of a ceaseless effort to harass and discredit Muslims. They point to the fact that charges against 7 have been stayed, and that only 1 has been convicted. The remaining 10 still face trial. And Muslims are aggrieved at the many visits that intelligence officers pay to homes and businesses for what is termed informal chats. They feel, they say, like a community under siege, guilty by association with the broadest of brushstrokes. Although the police and CSIS have numerous outreach programs, I've heard these views repeatedly from secular Muslims, from business people, from students, and from respected imams. Toronto is a huge, sprawling city. We've been driving for about 40 minutes, heading north to the suburb of Richmond Hill as the snow begins to fall. It's one of Canada's wealthiest communities, and I've come to the Islamic Center of York Region, two substantial buildings set on a 26-acre property. I'm here to see Zafar Bangash, the president of the center.
Do you feel that the Muslim community is a community under surveillance?
Oh, absolutely. I not only feel, I know it. I get calls from people all the time telling me that, you know, they have been visited at their place of work by CSIS agents. They're being interrogated. They're being, you know, asked about X, Y, Z and so on. And they're being harassed all the time. So it's not something that I feel. I know it. And I'm absolutely convinced that our centers are being monitored. And I've confronted the security officials on this as well.
When you look at these situations, what do you see? Because we're a liberal democracy, as some would argue, the most effective liberal democracy in the world. When these things happen, what does it say to you?
Well, what this indicates to me is that definitely the government is moving away from these values. That on the one hand, it claims that Canada is a pluralistic society, that we welcome everybody. And on the other hand, it is specifically targeting people of a particular faith.
The contradiction that Zafar Bangash highlights threatens to chip away at Canada's multicultural mosaic. But Canadians are still striving to achieve a middle ground. Sometimes, though, it's difficult.
Friday prayers are just ending. It's a very ordinary scene. Families leaving the mosque, getting into cars, or waiting at the bus stop. One woman, though, stands out in her niqab, her veil, and her burqa. She comes from a family that is at the center of a human rights debate that tests the limits of liberal democracy. Her name is Zainab Haddar.
The Haddars have been called Canada's first family of terror by the right-wing press. Zainab's father, an associate of Osama bin Laden, died in a firefight with Pakistani troops in 2003. One brother is paralyzed from the waist down after being wounded in the same battle. Another is in jail in Toronto fighting extradition to the United States on terror charges. And then there is her brother Omar, Guantanamo's youngest inmate. He was seized in Afghanistan at the age of 15 in 2002 and is still being held by the Americans 6 years on. Zainab, a tough and articulate 29-year-old, has assumed the mantle of family spokesperson. The majority of Canadians support the campaign to repatriate Omar. He is, after all, the only citizen of a Western country still held in Guantanamo. But at the same time, they find Zainab's hardline Islamist views abhorrent.
How do you view jihad?
How do I view jihad? I think everyone has a right to their land. I mean, I can't say that what the Afghans are doing is wrong. It would be unrealistic and unjust to say that.
This is the Taliban fighting the central government and the American and NATO forces.
I'm talking about the Afghans in general. I'm not talking about any particular Jama'ah or any particular people. I mean, if the people want to be governed by the Taliban, that's, as far as I'm concerned, is their problem or their right or whatever. I don't think the Americans should be there or the Canadians should be there. And I don't think that anyone should be able to say that what the Iraqis or the Afghans are doing is wrong. And if that is jihad, then I think they have a right to it.
If a young Muslim man came to you for advice and said, I want to go to Afghanistan to fight jihad, what would you say to that young man?
I would tell that person to teach himself his religion, to be a good person, to educate himself, to be able to stand up on their own. And if he feels that he wants to live in a Muslim country or be around Muslims, then if you feel you are ready to relocate, then do it. But know that it's always a struggle to move, to change, and it's not about the fight. The fighting is the easy part. You're excited and you go and you fight. That's not making a difference.
That's the easy part.
In a way, because, you know, in a rush, teenagers can go out together and, you know, one of them would do something really stupid and the other ones would just, in the rush, in the heat of the moment, would do it. So I think it's a lot more to do with building a person, building a society, building a family, than just the fight.
Should Canadians be worried that young Muslim men might carry out terrorist attacks here in Canada, as happened in Britain, in London?
I don't think so. I don't think there's anything to worry about. I would really hope, though, that the Canadian government would change its policies abroad, because I think that affects the relations between people in a country. I think that justice brings justice, just like injustice brings injustice or violence brings violence. So I think that if Canada just revises its policies, its international policies, then they will have nothing to fear.
What about the Toronto 18? Its allegation, charges have been dismissed or stayed in some cases, but there's still 10 people who are facing trial for what allegedly was a very, very serious attack.
The Toronto 18 is a hack. It's just a bunch of kids being crazy, and there is nothing to it. It's been 2.5 years. And if it wasn't for Mubin Sheikh, none of this case would have ever existed.
So Canadians can take it from you that they have nothing to fear.
In Canada? From Muslims in Canada? I don't think so.
Well, like I said, that'll be a relief for people then, because as you know, people do worry, and it has happened. It happened in the city I live in, London, with terrible consequence. When you look at an action like that, what do you think?
How do I look at it? That's a difficult question, and pain is pain. It hurts everybody the same. I don't think that the Americans or the British feel pain more than other people.
So, would you condemn that attack?
Well, I'm not the people who did it. I don't know why they did it. I don't know what drew them to do it, so I cannot be the one to speak on their behalf.
Well, they're dead, but surely you would have to take a view on it. You could say that this attack does not represent what Islam is all about. You could take that view, or you could, I suppose, take another view. I mean, I would just like to know what your view is.
I don't like to hear about people dying, but I cannot justify or condemn the actions of others. I think that's for them to do. And if they're dead, then, you know, God is the judge of their actions.
Many Canadians, including Muslim Canadians, are distressed, even frightened, by what Zainab Khader has to say. But they recognize she has the right to those views and the freedom to express them. Canadians take pride in the democracy and its openness. But there is less to be proud about in the case of Muslim Canadians like Mahir Arar. He was arrested in New York on his way back to Canada. He was sent to Syria and tortured. His case provoked a public outcry, a royal commission, and an apology and a $10 million settlement from the Canadian government. Less well known is the curious story of Aboussfian Abdulrazak, a Canadian of Sudanese origin. He went to Sudan to visit his mother, and he can't come home. His lawyer is Yavar Hamid.
After a few months of being in Sudan, he was called to a meeting by Sudanese authorities, and he was arrested, detained in 2 terms, spent approximately about 2 years in detention in Sudanese prisons, and there was no charge, there was no basis for those detentions. In the course of dealing with this case, I have learned through Privacy Act disclosures that the Government of Canada is highly implicated. Our documentation indicates quite clearly, in one document in particular from the Department of Foreign Affairs, that Mr. Abdulrazak back in 2003 was being held by the Sudanese at, quote-unquote, our request, the Canadian government's request.
CSIS became interested in Mr. Abdulrazak because he was acquainted with Ahmed Rassam, the man convicted in the United States in 2005 of attempting to blow up Los Angeles International Airport. We've been trying to reach him in Sudan via a computer call-up.
If you are Canadian.
Now, here's the strange thing about Mr. Abdulrazak. When he was released from jail, his passport had expired. The Canadian government refuses to renew it. But, being Canada, they've let him stay at the embassy for the last 8 months.
Operations Center, bonjour.
After several attempts, we get through, and I ask him what he would say to the Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, if he had the opportunity.
I would say to him that why he don't bring me back in Canada and charge me there. I'm willing for that.
You're willing to come back to Canada, and if you're charged, to defend yourself?
Yeah, if they claim they have evidence and to make a justice trial, I am willing. And I'm Canadian citizen. I have the right, I guess, to come back to Canada, and I really want to come back to Canada.
Can I ask you this? On its website, the U.S. State Department says that you pose a significant risk of committing acts of terrorism
It also claims that you're a member of an extremist cell in Montreal whose members include Ahmed Ressam, the so-called Millennium Bomber. Is that true?
That is not true. That's what they claimed. It's not true. I'm a religious person, but I'm a terrorist.
There has been no official explanation as to why Mr. Abdul Razak isn't being allowed to come home. But cases like these are creating new challenges and tensions. The government is charged with both protecting Canadians from terror and with upholding the rule of law. Many Muslims see the treatment of Mr. Abdul Razak and Mahir Arar as hypocrisy, a violation of everything a liberal democracy stands for. And extremists can use a contradiction to exploit young minds. So what is the way forward? Looking for an answer takes me to my hometown of Ottawa.
In that recent Environics poll, the thing that Muslims like least about Canada was the cold. And I can identify with that. It's minus 20. I'm standing outside what I used to know when I was a kid as the Cow Palace. It's in an area of Ottawa called Lansdowne Park. It's a Victorian structure, but the size of three football fields with a high arched roof. It's been lovingly restored. And in this cold, bright, sunny air, it looks beautiful. And thousands of Muslims from the Ottawa area have come to celebrate the first day of Eid.
Dr. Yihad Delic is a Bosnian immigrant who came to Canada in 1995. He's the executive director of the Canadian Islamic Congress.
I remember one young boy in Vancouver when I was imam in the largest mosque. He came to me and said, "I want to go to jihad." I looked at him, I gave him a smile. And I said, "Why?" He said, "I want to sacrifice something for God." I said, "Good. I need a volunteer in this mosque. And believe me, that would be your jihad. To serve your community, to serve your society. Giving your life for nothing. A, you are not a soldier. B, you'll be shot in a moment. I know, I come from Bosnia."
And this young man, did he take your advice?
Oh yeah. This young man, actually, he became my right hand. And he took on my advice. He went to college, he went to university. I went actually last year from here to perform his marriage back in Vancouver. A very successful young person, very good Canadian. So what sometimes these young people need, they just need a small advice, small direction.
But they can't get it from the wrong person.
You see, that's a problem. We are suggesting, I've been suggesting to several agencies of government that a radicalization example cannot be solved by CCs or RCMP. The only solution is right people from the community. People who know, A, text, and people who understand context, who are able to juggle between these two.
What Dr. Delic is suggesting is, of course, a very Canadian solution. Give Muslims the space and time to lead youth away from violent jihadism. That's a solution from within the community. But how do you deal with prejudices that exist both within and towards Canadian Muslims? Well, how about humor? When the Canadian sitcom Little Mosque on the Prairie launched in 2003, creator Zarqa Nawaz faced a storm of criticism.
I have noticed that every attitude that we expose, the people who own that attitude aren't happy with it, right? The right wing doesn't like being made fun of. The Orthodox Muslims don't like being made fun of. You do it, but, you know, there's a price to pay because people are very sensitive. They don't see themselves the way we see them. You know, they're like, "Are you making fun of us? Are you mocking us?"
Despite the initial criticism, the show has been a hit. In its gentle, very Canadian way, Little Mosque on the Prairie extracts the sting from ignorance and animosity. And it's not alone. Young Muslims are exploiting the internet and using comedy to make their point. "Frisk me, I'm a Muslim." That's on a t-shirt you can snap up online for just $15.
Whenever I go on the internet, you know, there's all sorts of websites that are... Have you heard of hijabman.com?
No.
And so there's all these websites popping up, hijabman, maniac Muslim. So there's all these websites from these young Muslims who are growing up in North America who are... And I think you have to be well integrated into North America to be able to make fun of yourself and your community. The way the Jewish community responded to prejudice back in, you know, the day in the 1920s and 30s. And so you see the best sitcoms that have come out in Hollywood have been from Jewish comics. And I think now you're seeing a similar pattern happening from the Muslim community. And I think it almost took that type of oppression to bring it out, because then you have a subject to talk about. And, you know, you can diffuse all the ignorance and hate with humor. And so I think that, you know, in 10, 20 years from now, you will see a sort of a different landscape. In the entertainment world, you'll see a lot more Muslims talking about these issues.
Maybe by then, Canadians, be they Muslim or otherwise, can relax. In the meantime, though, the promise of a multicultural society where people are free to practice their religion and prosper remains a threat. From the tiny minority who cynically exploit the freedoms Canada offers, and ironically, from the dangers that an overreaction to that minority can produce. But Canada, being Canada, will probably muddle through to what pollster Michael Adams calls a reasonable accommodation. How boring, how Canadian, I say to him. Yeah, he replies, but it works. Thank you for listening to the Crossing Continents podcast. If you'd like to find out more about Cross, log on to our website at Thank you for listening to the Crossing Continents podcast. If you'd like to find out more about Cross, log on to our website at Unlike another Crown witness, Mubin Sheikh refused the offer of going into a witness protection program. He says to do that would be to suggest that he had done something wrong. More importantly, it would silence his voice in the community. He says more Muslims like him need to openly challenge extremism. But he's paid the price for that decision.
I was cursed. My children were cursed. My family was cursed.
Cursed by?
Well, other people. Other so-called Muslims, right? I mean, mostly online muftis, right? Cyber muftis, right? These are the wackos that, you know, they go online, they read a verse in English, and they think, ah, yes, this is what the Quran says. And then they go out and they teach this, and because they think they're big scholars now, right? It's a do-it-yourself Islam.
Defense lawyers contend that Mubin Sheikh was in effect an agent provocateur. He is well known in the Toronto Muslim community, and before the alleged plot was uncovered, was respected by young Muslims both for his Islamic scholarship and his fundamentalist views. It was a scholarship that ultimately convinced him that violent jihad was un-Islamic. But before that time, he admits he was attracted to militant Islam.
There are people that you knew from the area, not necessarily from the area, but from the Muslim community, that you could go to if you were interested in doing so. And because I have family in India also, that was another route that I could have taken. I remember being told that, well, you know, sit tight, go to India, under the guise of visiting grandparents or whatever, and from there you can find your way. We will make a way for you, right? So in those years of angry youth, you know, it was like a very modern juxtaposition, because on one hand I was very jihadi, but on the other hand I was into music and, you know, doing all kinds of things. And so I did look at wanting to go, and I did feel that, you know, Afghanistan was always the theater of choice, right?
Many in the Muslim community believe that the Toronto 18 are innocent victims of a ceaseless effort to harass and discredit Muslims. They point to the fact that charges against 7 have been stayed and that only 1 has been convicted. The remaining 10 still face trial. And Muslims are aggrieved at the many visits that intelligence officers pay to homes and businesses for what is termed informal chats. They feel, they say, like a community under siege, guilty by association with the broadest of brushstrokes. Although the police and CSIS have numerous outreach programs, I've heard these views repeatedly from secular Muslims, from business people, from students, and from respected imams. Toronto is a huge, sprawling city. We've been driving for about 40 minutes, heading north to the suburb of Richmond Hill as the snow begins to fall. It's one of Canada's wealthiest communities, and I've come to the Islamic Center of York Region, two substantial buildings set on a 26-acre property. I'm here to see Zafar Bangash, the president of the center. Do you feel that the Muslim community is a community under surveillance?
Oh, absolutely. I not only feel, I know it. I get calls from people all the time telling me that, you know, they have been visited at their place of work by CSIS agents. They're being interrogated. They're being, you know, asked about X, Y, Z, and so on. And they're being harassed all the time. So it's not something that I feel. I know it. And I'm absolutely convinced that our centers are being monitored. And I've confronted the security officials on this as well.
When you look at these situations, what you see, because we're a liberal democracy, as some would argue, the most effective liberal democracy in the world, when these things happen, what does it say to you?
Well, what this indicates to me is that definitely the government is moving away from these values. That on the one hand, it claims that Canada is a pluralistic society, that we welcome everybody. And on the other hand, it is specifically targeting people of a particular faith.
The contradiction that Savar Bangash highlights threatens to chip away at Canada's multicultural mosaic. But Canadians are still striving to achieve a middle ground. Sometimes, though, it's difficult.
Friday prayers are just ending. It's a very ordinary scene. Families leaving the mosque, getting into cars, or waiting at the bus stop. One woman, though, stands out in her niqab, her veil, and her burqa. She comes from a family that is at the center of a human rights debate that tests the limits of liberal democracy. Her name is Zainab Haddar.
The Haddars have been called Canada's first family of terror by the right-wing press. Zainab's father, an associate of Osama bin Laden, died in a firefight with Pakistani troops in 2003. One brother is paralyzed from the waist down after being wounded in the same battle. Another is in jail in Toronto fighting extradition to the United States on terror charges. And then there is her brother Omar, Guantanamo's youngest inmate. He was seized in Afghanistan at the age of 15 in 2002 and is still being held by the Americans 6 years on. Zainab, a tough and articulate 29-year-old, has assumed the mantle of family spokesperson. The majority of Canadians support the campaign to repatriate Omar. He is, after all, the only citizen of a Western country still held in Guantanamo. But at the same time, they find Zainab's hardline Islamist views abhorrent.
How do you view jihad?
How do I view jihad? I think everyone has a right to their land. I mean, I can't say that what the Afghans are doing is wrong. It would be unrealistic and unjust to say that.
This is the Taliban fighting the central government and the American and NATO forces.
I'm talking about the Afghans in general. I'm not talking about any particular Jamaa or any particular people. I mean, if the people want to be governed by the Taliban, that's, as far as I'm concerned, is their problem or their right or whatever. I don't think the Americans should be there or the Canadians should be there. And I don't think that anyone should be able to say that what the Iraqis or the Afghans are doing is wrong. And if that is jihad, then I think they have a right to it.
If a young Muslim man came to you for advice and said, I want to go to Afghanistan to fight jihad, what would you say to that young man?
I would tell that person to teach himself his religion, to be a good person, to educate himself, to be able to stand up on their own. And if he feels that he wants to live in a Muslim country or be around Muslims, then if you feel you are ready to relocate, then do it. But know that it's always a struggle to move, to change, and it's not about the fight. The fighting is the easy part. You're excited and you go and you fight. That's not making a difference.
That's the easy part.
In a way, because, you know, in a rush, teenagers can go out together and, you know, one of them would do something really stupid and the other ones would just, in the rush, in the heat of the moment, would do it. So I think it's a lot more to do with building a person, building a society, building a family, than just the fight.
Should Canadians be worried that young Muslim men might carry out terrorist attacks here in Canada, as happened in Britain, in London?
I don't think so. I don't think there's anything to worry about. I would really hope, though, that the Canadian government would change its policies abroad, because I think that affects the relations between people in a country. I think that justice brings justice, just like injustice brings injustice or violence brings violence. So I think that if Canada just revises its policies, its international policies, then they will have nothing to fear.
What about the Toronto 18? Its allegation, charges have been dismissed or stayed in some cases, but there's still 10 people who are facing trial for what allegedly was a very, very serious attack.
The Toronto 18 is a hack. It's just a bunch of kids being crazy, and there is nothing to it. It's been 2.5 years. And if it wasn't for Mubin Sheikh, none of this case would have ever existed.
So, Canadians can take it from you that they have nothing to fear.
In Canada? From Muslims in Canada? I don't think so.
Well, like I said, that'll be a relief for people then, because as you know, people do worry, and it has happened. It happened in the city I live in, London, with terrible consequence. When you look at an action like that, what do you think?
How do I look at it? That's a difficult question, and pain is pain. It hurts everybody the same. I don't think that the Americans or the British feel pain more than other people.
So, would you condemn that attack?
Well, I'm not the people who did it. I don't know why they did it. I don't know what drew them to do it, so I cannot be the one to speak on their behalf.
Well, they're dead, but surely you would have to take a view on it. You could say that this attack does not represent what Islam is all about. You could take that view, or you could, I suppose, take another view. I mean, I would just like to know what your view is.
I don't like to hear about people dying, but I cannot justify or condemn the actions of others. I think that's for them to do. And if they're dead, then, you know, God is the judge of their actions.
Many Canadians, including Muslim Canadians, are distressed, even frightened, by what Zainab Khader has to say. But they recognize she has the right to those views and the freedom to express them. Canadians take pride in the democracy and its openness. But there is less to be proud about in the case of Muslim Canadians like Mahir Arar. He was arrested in New York on his way back to Canada. He was sent to Syria and tortured. His case provoked a public outcry, a royal commission, and an apology and a $10 million settlement from the Canadian government. Less well known is the curious story of Aboussfian Abdulrazak, a Canadian of Sudanese origin. He went to Sudan to visit his mother, and he can't come home. His lawyer is Yavar Hamid.
After a few months of being in Sudan, he was called to a meeting by Sudanese authorities, and he was arrested, detained in 2 terms, spent approximately about 2 years in detention in Sudanese prisons, and there was no charge, there was no basis for those detentions. In the course of dealing with this case, I have learned through Privacy Act disclosures that the Government of Canada is highly implicated. Our documentation indicates quite clearly, in one document in particular from the Department of Foreign Affairs, that Mr. Abdulrazak back in 2003 was being held by the Sudanese at, quote-unquote, our request, the Canadian government's request.
CSIS became interested in Mr. Abdulrazak because he was acquainted with Ahmed Rassam, the man convicted in the United States in 2005 of attempting to blow up Los Angeles International Airport. We've been trying to reach him in Sudan via a computer call-up.
If you are Canadian.
Now, here's the strange thing about Mr. Abdulrazak. When he was released from jail, his passport had expired. The Canadian government refuses to renew it. But, being Canada, they've let him stay at the embassy for the last 8 months.
Operations Center, bonjour.
After several attempts, we get through, and I ask him what he would say to the Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, if he had the opportunity.
I would say to him that why he don't bring me back in Canada and charge me there. I'm willing for that.
You're willing to come back to Canada, and if you're charged, to defend yourself?
Yeah, if they claim they have evidence and to make a justice trial, I am willing. And I'm Canadian citizen. I have the right, I guess, to come back to Canada, and I really want to come back to Canada.
Can I ask you this? On its website, the U.S. State Department says that you pose a significant risk of committing acts of terrorism. It also claims that you're a member of an extremist cell in Montreal whose members include Ahmed Rassam, the so-called Millennium Bomber. Is that true?
That is not true. That's what they claimed. It's not true. I'm a religious person, but I'm a terrorist.
There has been no official explanation as to why Mr. Abdulrazak isn't being allowed to come home. But cases like these are creating new challenges and tensions. The government is charged with both protecting Canadians from terror and with upholding the rule of law. Many Muslims see the treatment of Mr. Abdul Razak and Mahir Arar as hypocrisy, a violation of everything a liberal democracy stands for. And extremists can use a contradiction to exploit young minds. So what is the way forward? Looking for an answer takes me to my hometown of Ottawa.
In that recent Environics poll, the thing that Muslims like least about Canada was the cold. And I can identify with that. It's minus 20. I'm standing outside what I used to know when I was a kid as the Cow Palace. It's in an area of Ottawa called Lansdowne Park. It's a Victorian structure, but the size of three football fields with a high arched roof. It's been lovingly restored. And in this cold, bright, sunny air, it looks beautiful. And thousands of Muslims from the Ottawa area have come to celebrate the first day of Eid.
Dr. Yihad Delic is a Bosnian immigrant who came to Canada in 1995. He's the executive director of the Canadian Islamic Congress.
I remember one young boy in Vancouver when I was imam in the largest mosque. He came to me and said, "I want to go to jihad." I looked at him, I gave him a smile. And I said, "Why?" He said, "I want to sacrifice something for God." I said, "Good. I need a volunteer in this mosque. And believe me, that would be your jihad. To serve your community, to serve your society. Giving your life for nothing. A, you are not a soldier. B, you'll be shot in a moment. I know, I come from Bosnia."
And this young man, did he take your advice?
Oh yeah. This young man, actually, he became my right hand. And he took on my advice. He went to college, he went to university. I went actually last year from here to perform his marriage back in Vancouver. A very successful young person, very good Canadian. So what sometimes these young people need, they just need a small advice, small direction.
But they can't get it from the wrong person.
You see, that's a problem. We are suggesting, I've been suggesting to several agencies of government that a radicalization example cannot be solved by CCs or RCMP. The only solution is right people from the community. People who know, A, text, and people who understand context, who are able to juggle between these two.
What Dr. Delic is suggesting is, of course, a very Canadian solution. Give Muslims the space and time to lead youth away from violent jihadism. That's a solution from within the community. But how do you deal with prejudices that exist both within and towards Canadian Muslims? Well, how about humor? When the Canadian sitcom Little Mosque on the Prairie launched in 2003, creator Zarqa Nawaz faced a storm of criticism.
I have noticed that every attitude that we expose, the people who own that attitude aren't happy with it, right? The right wing doesn't like being made fun of. The Orthodox Muslims don't like being made fun of. You do it, but, you know, there's a price to pay because people are very sensitive. They don't see themselves the way we see them. You know, they're like, "Are you making fun of us? Are you mocking us?"
Despite the initial criticism, the show has been a hit. In its gentle, very Canadian way, Little Mosque on the Prairie extracts the sting from ignorance and animosity. And it's not alone. Young Muslims are exploiting the internet and using comedy to make their point. "Frisk me, I'm a Muslim." That's on a t-shirt you can snap up online for just $15.
Whenever I go on the internet, you know, there's all sorts of websites that are... Have you heard of hijabman.com?
No.
And so there's all these websites popping up, hijabman, maniac Muslim. So there's all these websites from these young Muslims who are growing up in North America who are... And I think you have to be well integrated into North America to be able to make fun of yourself and your community. The way the Jewish community responded to prejudice back in, you know, the day in the 1920s and 30s. And so you see the best sitcoms that have come out in Hollywood have been from Jewish comics. And I think now you're seeing a similar pattern happening from the Muslim community. And I think it almost took that type of oppression to bring it out, because then you have a subject to talk about. And, you know, you can diffuse all the ignorance and hate with humor. And so I think that, you know, in 10, 20 years from now, you will see a sort of a different landscape. In the entertainment world, you'll see a lot more Muslims talking about these issues.
Maybe by then, Canadians, be they Muslim or otherwise, can relax. In the meantime, though, the promise of a multicultural society where people are free to practice their religion and prosper remains a threat. From the tiny minority who cynically exploit the freedoms Canada offers, and ironically from the dangers that an overreaction to that minority can produce. But Canada, being Canada, will probably muddle through to what pollster Michael Adams calls a reasonable accommodation. How boring, how Canadian, I say to him. Yeah, he replies, but it works. Thank you for listening to the Crossing Continents podcast. If you'd like to find out more about Cross, log on to our website at bbc.com.